many hundreds of dollars. And we brought it back, and it was just an incredible impression, putting this in the room and generating these frequencies that allowed these elderly people to get a good night's sleep. And we've only been back for just a few days, and I've already got some really nice emails back from some of these senior folks saying, I can't believe how well I'm sleeping with this. Better than medication, better than anything that energy during the day and able to sleep at night. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. And this, again, is technology that's been around for a good little while. So let me stop scattering about my recent travels and get back into the reason that we're here. And this is our weekly coaching call. We love our opportunity to have our coaching calls because it kind of helps us as individuals on a progressive pattern toward becoming health coaches. It allows us to get together and talk about the things that are important to us as health coaches. And remember, this is something of a career path that we're talking about. It's not simply an opportunity to get together and chat, which is wonderful in and of itself, but it's chatting with a purpose. It's an opportunity to help other individuals find their power and change their lives. Now, having said that, we, of course, are doing nothing more than reflective listening. That's what we do. We're coaches, right? And as coaches, we don't have to tell somebody what to do. We don't have to, like a sports metaphor, the sports coach doesn't get out and play the game. Right? They basically look at the talents that an individual has and help them reflectively see what talents they possess that they can bring to bear in finding their own dream, their own mission, their own pathway, and then shine that light on their own pathway so that they can actually illuminate, find those that next step that they need to take, and then move ahead with their own dream. Certainly nothing that we would be steering them or guiding them toward. That's one of the reasons why, as we look at health coaching and how it's done around the United States, we really see a digression away from coaching and into teaching or into consulting. But if you can imagine the parallel lines, when you're looking at a teacher and a student, can you see the automatic disparity between teacher and student? The teacher and student is saying, I know things that you don't know, and I am going to impart those to you. Whereas that's a very valuable relationship, teacher to student. That's not the coaching relationship. Well, how about the mentor-mentee, right, the mentor relationship? That comes from the book, Homer's Odyssey and the Iliad. When he's off on his Odyssey, he leaves his young son with a wise goat herder named Mentor. And he tells him, teach him everything that you know. And that is the job of the mentor. But that's not the job of the coach. We're not teaching anyone anything. Even a consultant. The consultant has specialized knowledge that they need to impart in a singular area to an individual who lacks that specialized knowledge. That's a great relationship, but not the job of a coach. A coach's job is to help an individual see with clarity what their own individual personal vision is. And in fact, a coach's job is to become invisible. So instead of a coach being on an equal footing with the person that they're training, the coaching client, the coach becomes invisible and they eventually take themselves out of the equation completely. So the coach's job is one where you're trying to work yourself into obscurity, where you're trying, rather than becoming an expert in any topic, you're backing away and simply letting the individual be the expert on the one subject they know best, and that is them. Right? We simply couldn't begin to pretend to know that we know as much about an individual as they know about themselves. Isn't that true? An individual always knows more about themselves than we could ever possibly know about them. So as a coach, if we wanted to come in and try and instruct someone how they should behave, how they should act, how they should think, what they should do, we've already placed ourselves at a significant disadvantage because they're already smarter about themselves than we could ever be, right? You are a PhD in you. and that's the only subject you know with any great level of expertise. And the individual coaching client that we have is a PhD in them, and we need to let them be that expert, right? Because they frankly are, right? So it's not a case of us letting them. We need to recognize that they are the expert in them. And then we need to shine reflectively a light back that helps them understand who they really are, what they really want, and what steps that they know already that they need to be taking. And that's what coaching is about. And remember our call here this week and every week. This is we call this our friends and family call because we are all coaches at various stages of evolution and development. We're all coaches, and we call this a friends and family call because we're not pretending that this is going to make you into the best certified coach or that this is going to make you competent as in the coaching arena, but rather that we have an opportunity to kind of kick around some ideas and share some things. And I always look forward to your emails back on our coaching call and some things we'd like to discuss again. A friends and family call is really about us having a moment to share without the pressure of performance. No performance anxiety here, but instead an opportunity for us to share in how we bring people to a moment of clarity. This is not a sales call. There's no business opportunity. There's no recruiting here. You're not going to be asked to join a secret cult. This is just coaching. And it really revolves around all of our own shared journey as health coaches, not in a superior-inferior relationship, not a parent-child relationship or a teacher-student relationship or a mentor-client relationship or a consultant relationship, nothing. The assumption with all of these relationships is that there is a deficiency in the people that are our clients. As a coach, that's simply not true. Just imagine, the job of a consultant is to say, I have specialized knowledge that you lack, and I am going to impart that to you. That's already out of the boundaries, out of the definition of a coaching call. What if you're a teacher? I have special knowledge, and I'm going to show you how to apply this special knowledge so that you can internalize this for yourself. Totally out of character with health coaching. Instead of the assumption that the person is somehow lacking, that there's something wrong with them that needs fixing, that there's something deficient in them that needs to be filled up, we assume that the person is whole, that they are complete and perfect as they are. That's our assumption. But what they need is clarity of vision. That's what we are hopefully engaged in the process of imparting. And that's where true empowerment comes from. Empowerment comes from us being kissed by a muse. Empowerment comes from us seeing our vision and grabbing a hold of it and possessing it and having it possess us. Power comes from obsession with our own personal vision, our own mission, our own passion, our own sense of purpose. That's what coaching is, to help you see the power inside of you, not to empower you to do anything, not to motivate you to do anything, but in order to help you see with great clarity those things that motivate you, that impel you from within and compel you from without. So for us on our call, we try to be the voice of clarity. It's about the message, not about the messenger. Take yourself out of the equation. And I can tell you something. That is extraordinarily liberating when you can take yourself completely out of the equation and now you're not part of that discussion at all, except in reflective listening, when you can listen to an individual, really truly hear them and play back to them what they're saying to you so that they can hear themselves. And isn't that what communication is, right? So communication is about listening and learning to listen better. Always assume that you can listen better than you do right now. Communication is about helping each one of us then to reflectively, that is in a constructive way, play back what we hear another person say. And don't be afraid to ask, you know what I'm hearing you say is X. Is that correct? Am I hearing this correctly? Please elaborate. Would you please expand on that comment? Right? Always assume you can listen better. Always assume that you can communicate better with the people that you're talking to. Spend your time and your money learning the skills that you need to listen better and to communicate better, and that's when you will succeed. Now, that brings us to our regular coaching call comments, our questions that we always try to go through with every single client, every moment, every encounter. And we do this also in self-coaching. We do this with ourselves. We ask, what do we want? You see, that's where motion begins. That's where purpose, passion, mission begins. That's the seedlings of the plan that we're going to have to take us to our destination, is by being clear and clearer and ultimately clear about what it is we truly want. And then we ask, what's important about that? So for us, we need to make a list about the things that we want, the things that we really want, the things that we really, really want. Make a list and then spend some time engaging in a discussion about what's important about these. Now, we don't always ask, why do you want something? Why is too big of a question for now? Why may be culturally relevant. It might be relevant to a psychiatrist. It might be relevant to transgenerational discussions or community discussions. But for now, let's just talk about what's important about the things that we want. Talk about our strengths, what we bring to this occasion, and who we are at our best. And talk about our weaknesses, our challenge, the issues that might keep us from fully accomplishing the things that we're setting out to accomplish, right? Who are we at our worst? And what does this voice of the inner council of critics say to us in our darkest moment, in our weakest moment? And then with that in mind, let's redefine what it is we want and what we should do to get there. Not what we will do just yet. Let's define what we should do. And then we'll define what we will do as an individual, and also who we can recruit to help us along our way. But going back to what we should do, remember, what we should do and what we will do, there's often a gap. That gap between our thoughts and our actions, that is what we know we should be doing and what we're actually doing, that is the gap called an integrity gap. Integrity is really about a unity or an integrating of our thoughts and our actions. And to the extent that we are integrated in thought and action, we have integrity, we have lives of integrity, we are people of integrity. Integrity is defined as a unity of thought and action. So when we say what should we do and what will we do, we need to close the gap of integrity so that what we should do is what we will do. And if not done by us, then done by those that we influence. And, of course, always done in a timely fashion. And we have our SMART goals to kind of help us reach that. Coaching is about establishing a sense of commitment about the things that are truly important and escalating that, that level of commitment until it really encompasses our entire field of vision. A coach's job is to help bring that moment to clarity, co-design accountability, help assign tasks, and set up the reward and penalty model that, frankly, we all function on, whether we like it or not, whether we think we're more mature than that or not. We set up our reward and penalty, and then we stand by, and we excuse ourselves from that circumstance as we wait for as we wait for action on the sign on the part of our client. Action is really what sparks the new cycle of coaching. And frankly, we don't have anywhere to go until our client takes an action step. Now, it might be a small action step, and it might be a really large one. That's not for us to say. Our job is to discern that action. Now, here's kind of where we had gotten into our discussion. Tonight's discussion is significantly about self-sabotage. When we've gotten into our line of discussion on the stages of change as presented by Prashatka in his book, Changing for Good. Now, change is kind of an interesting concept. Change assumes motion, but sometimes that motion is internal. Sometimes that motion is tiny, and we have to be aware that an individual is progressing from one stage to another stage. And we'll go over the stages of change here in just a moment. But one thing to remember as we go into it is not to judge the change of another by what we would think to see in ourselves. We've got to take ourselves completely out of the circumstance, make ourselves invisible even to us. That's when we become successful as a coach. And remember, if a person doesn't want what we want, that doesn't mean that their want is wrong. If their beliefs are other than our beliefs, we shouldn't try to correct them. Instead, we should just recognize, perhaps play back, perhaps reflectively listen to it. Now, if somebody has a particularly ridiculous belief, and we're really finding it hard to hold our tongue, let's just assume somebody has decided that the earth is in fact flat. This is a flat earth, and you can't tell me any different. You know, about the most we can do is we can pull the old Dr. Phil out, and we can say, how's that working out for you? Because really, a coach's job is to be invisible. We are not to judge what an individual's beliefs are. If they want to believe the world is flat, our assumption is still that they are whole, complete, and perfect for the mission that they're setting out to accomplish. So what their belief system is entirely up to them and has nothing to do with us. We just simply feedback in a reflective listening way. So in fact, for us, the big concept is to not necessarily try to understand them, because we may never understand our coaching client. We may not. And we'll ask him to explain again and again. But if somebody believes the earth is flat and we believe it's round, we may never come to the point of understanding them. Or we may. But we can only come to understand someone when we are willing to give up trying to change them into a copy of us. And that's when we can first begin to actually understand another individual, if that level of understanding is even at all possible. So we were talking about change, and we're talking about motion. The biggest changes that we have, according to Prashatka's stages of change, are the change from not being aware of an issue, of a circumstance, of a problem, or of a solution, not being aware of it, to being aware of. Now notice I didn't say that you're taking action on it or that you can even explain it, but that you've gone from that lack of awareness that something even exists to an awareness that perhaps this is a reality, at least on some level. That's a huge change, and yet you really haven't seen any action. We're a long ways from action, in fact. And the biggest challenge for a coach is to see, to intuit that has changed. They've gone from a place where they're saying, yes, I'm a three-pack-a-day smoker, to, yes, I'm a three-pack-a-day smoker, and I'd really like to stop. You see, that is a huge change. And if we're not willing to settle down and slow down and take ourselves out of the circumstance and stop trying to tell them that smoking is wrong, 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 if we're not ready to do that, then we're not going to notice that most significant change in an individual's life. Now let's just think about the changes that a person goes through. I mentioned that sometimes the person is not even aware of a problem, and then they become aware of it. And then perhaps they decide if they're going to take action on that. And that's a stage of preparation. Once they take action, there's two possibilities. Either they'll sustain that action through maintenance, or they will self-sabotage. That is, they'll regress back to an earlier stage. So these are the six stages of change in Prashatka's model. He's a professor at the University of Rhode Island. So he says, when a person's not even aware that it's an issue, They call that the stage of pre-contemplation. And I can't tell you, as a holistic healthcare provider, how many times I have somebody come into my office and say, I'm only here because my wife told me I had to come. Or I'm only here because my parents are making me come. Or my kids are telling me I'm starting to act up, or et cetera, et cetera, right? I'm here because somebody else made me come here. Probably my number one experience along these lines are when a person is snoring and their spouse sends them for care. Now, they don't even know they're snoring. And I have to say, an individual who's snoring, this is even without sleep apnea, is doing significant damage to the vascular endothelium of the circulatory system. A person who's snoring is losing IQ points every single year they're snoring. A person who's snoring is damaging their own health and their own mentality and placing themselves at a higher risk for all disease, but especially for metabolic syndrome, prediabetes, diabetes, and therefore heart disease. So snoring is not something innocuous and harmless. And if you thought that, please adjust your viewpoint. But on the other hand, it's their spouse whose health is being ruined because of their snoring. So their spouse sends them in. I don't know why I'm here. My spouse sent me here because she says I snore, he says I snore. I'm not even aware I snore. I sleep just fine. Thank you very much. Not really an awful lot that you can do with somebody like that because they're in pre-contemplation. They may have a vague sense that there's something wrong, but there's no way that they can define it, nor do they choose to define it. Instead, they're in that state before change is possible. Change is simply not possible. There's an old saying that one of my mentors, one of my teachers used to say, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. I don't know where he got that, by the way. But I'm thankful that he imparted that to me, because that's absolutely true. You simply cannot motivate somebody for long-term change to do something that they don't want to do. That's the job of the coach, right? Help them to see that. Or especially something they don't even recognize as a concern. They don't even see it as a problem. And they're in that state of pre-contemplation. What can we do with somebody like that? Well, I'll guarantee you there's very little more that we can do than help them understand, perhaps, that there is a perspective other than the one they're currently embedded in. And with that idea that there is another world out there, if they come in and swear to you that the earth is flat, have them explain that to you, ask them how it is that that affects their day-to-day actions, how it is that that affects their ability to make decisions, and what other people may think. How many people do you know that also believe that the earth is flat? And how many people do you know that believe that the earth is a shape other than flat? And what's the most common shape that you hear? And how is their life different than your life? And in what way is their outcome superior? In what way is the outcome of their life inferior? And you begin to continue that conversation until the moment that you see what I believe is the most significant change in an individual's life. And that is awareness that some other choice is possible. You see, we all have the ability to make better choices, but only if we believe or understand or have the knowledge that the choice is even possible. I got to say, this is something that I found when working with the mentally ill, and especially in working with the individuals that are homeless. They didn't like where they were necessarily, but they couldn't understand that there was even the ability to make a different choice in that state of pre-contemplation. When they began to make the biggest, most monumental changes in their life was not when they took action to seek help for mental illness or took action to end their homelessness, but when they recognized that there was some other way, that there was some other choice. Even if it was only a vague sense that there was something bigger and better out there, and that was something that they should explore or perhaps even desire, that's a huge change. And we have to be quiet. We have to be still in order to hear when that moment of change actually occurs. But when it happens, that's a moment of absolute rejoicing. We're partying now. We're happy because we've seen the biggest possible change, one where they didn't recognize that there was even a concern, an issue, a problem, or an opportunity, to one where they actually could see a larger world. Their world just got bigger because they recognized there was an opportunity or a possibility for change. And now they have gone from that state of pre-contemplation to the state of contemplation. Contemplation, what does that mean? That means I recognize there is another life out there. There's another world. There's another series of opportunities. You know, in my own class, I used to ask people the question, who has your life? And we would look at popular characters on television and novels, in books and magazines, and you know, I mean, think of a popular person. As we were coming on, we were having a discussion about President George Bush and President Barack Obama, and you think about when a young person is being told, you could grow up to be president, just like President Bush or just like President Obama. You could grow up to be just like that. You know what? All of us are in a state where we can grow up to be whatever we want to be. So let's take a look at who has our life. That's a state of contemplation, when we're starting to think that other things, things other than our present reality, are actually possible. Now, of course, there are some impossible things. I'm a man. I'll never have a baby. That's the way it works. And you know what? I'm a senior now. Yeah, nobody laughs. I'm a senior now, and I will never be the first man on the moon. In fact, I'll probably never go to the moon. And that's just the way it is, and that's okay with me. There are certain things that are impossible, but those are relatively small compared to all the things that are possible. So why would we focus on making our world smaller by thinking of the things we can't do, when we have the opportunity to contemplate the things we can do and make our world big, bigger, and biggest? One very quick other opportunity for a conversation, a coaching conversation I had recently, dealt with diet. Someone was asking me to be a consultant and help them determine the best diet. And I would ask them the coaching question. You know, what do you think the best diet is? What foods have you eaten that made you feel bad? What foods do you eat that make you feel good? Where do you get your energy? And what do you think is the most important diet rules that you could be following? And oh my goodness, they were absolutely skilled at trying to get me to make a decision for them. But I'm a coach. I don't make decisions for other people. And what a liberating position that is. So I would talk to them, tell them stories, ask them questions, listen attentively, and eventually tell them, you know, let me tell you what my belief is. My belief is that people know one thing that they could be doing dietarily. They know one thing that they could be doing better than they're doing. What is it for you? What's the second? What's the third item? What's something that you're doing right now that you know you shouldn't be doing? And of course, they were completely aware of this, and they were trying to pull me in to make the discussion about diet. And I finally told them, you know, we torture ourselves entirely too much by setting up these rules that we have no intentions of following. Or even if we did follow them, we just sucked the entire joy out of the process of having dinner because we have all of these meticulous little rules that we have to follow. And I pointed out something that is it's a truism from psychophysiology, from stress medicine, from mind-body medicine. And what I'm going to tell you is real. If an individual has a spoonful of sugar in something, whether it's apple pie or Coca-Cola, if you have a spoonful of sugar and you look at your macrophage, that is your immune system activity, before that spoonful of sugar, and afterward, you see a remarkable reduction in your ability to fight infection, to fight disease after a spoonful of sugar. And it's that way for hours. A spoonful of sugar, it might be 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, it might even be 6 hours. that your immune system is suppressed by having a spoonful of sugar. So if you're fighting a disease or if you want to become as healthy as you possibly can, avoid refined sugar. Now, here's the real important part. If we look at an individual who has a moment of angst, of anxiety, of anger, a confrontation, do you know how long it takes you to get over a confrontation? It can take 3 days to 3 weeks to get over a confrontation, and it's immune-suppressing quality. That is, its ability to interfere with your capabilities of fighting disease, fighting infection. So let me ask you something. What's more important, that we eat a good diet or that we avoid fights and angst and anxiety about the diet? You see, sometimes we beat people up entirely too much about the things that they eat and drink, when what we really should be doing is looking for a way to expand their horizon, to make their world bigger, and say, look at all of these other foods you haven't even tried before. Try this. Google foods for November, foods for December, foods for January. Just Google that and find all the foods that become ripe that you haven't even eaten yourself. And so instead of worrying about, am I going to avoid all dairy products, and is fermented dairy different than pasteurized dairy, and should I get raw milk, and what about goat's milk, and what about butter? Instead of thinking about those things that you can't have, shouldn't have, won't have, think about the things you've never tried before and that you'd love to discover and explore and that you will have in your future. Make your world bigger instead of making your world smaller. Now you've entered into the world of contemplation. You're thinking about making your world a bigger place. Of course, you know, back to the issue of diet. Now we have to deal with actual preparation. Are you going to, you've understood that turnips are in season in January, are you going to actually find out where you can purchase a turnip? Are you going to find out what kind of a recipe you would have for the turnip? Are you going to plan the day that you're going to go buy that turnip and then the day that you're going to prepare it and serve it and enjoy that turnip, eat it yourself? You see, those are the kinds of things that are the hallmark of moving from pre-contemplation to contemplation, from contemplation to preparation. Now you've prepared to do it, and now you have an action plan. I'm going to buy this vegetable. I'm going to prepare it in this way. I'm going to buy it on this day. I'm going to spend time here putting this together, and I'm going to eat it and enjoy it with the people I love on this day. And then you execute it. Now you've moved into action. So from pre-contemplation to contemplation, biggest change ever. Contemplation to preparation, preparation to action. And now you move into the area of tonight's discussion, which is, once again, are you going to maintain that, or are you going to sabotage this effort? Even if you do it once, now you've made the commitment that you're going to try a new food every month, or every week, or every day. And just for those of you who are into the philosophy of diet changes, the Japanese say that for every new food you add to your diet, you add 100 days to your lifespan. So if you want to live forever, lots of new foods. So now we have the opportunity to slide back into our previous habits where we're eating exactly the same things in exactly the same way. Or we have the opportunity to fulfill our goal of saying we're going to expand our dietary choices. And of course, understand I'm using diet simply as an example, an illustration. We have 100, 1,000, a million different choices that we could make that we're just illustrating with diet. Could be that you want to try a new color of clothing, or a new style of shoes, or a new way of combing your hair. But there's always things that you can change once you recognize that change is possible, and perhaps that this will lead to a desired state, and then we can take that action. Now, when we get to sabotage, what is it about sabotage that makes us all, and I mean myself included, what is it that makes us slip back into the self-sabotage? Well, a lot of that has to do with our desire to keep things relatively calm and relatively stable. Our nervous system just loves consistency and predictability. And bless our own little hearts, we need things to be the same, whereas we desire for things to change. Can you see that little tug of war that we have constantly in our minds and in our hearts? We want things to improve. We want them to get better. We want them to progress. And yet, we still crave the consistency and predictability of sameness. Well, that little tug of war, frankly, sameness wins more often than not. And in fact, many times I remember a saying about individuals who would rather be ruined than be changed, right? Who would rather die than face the actual dispersing of their own illusions about how things should be, right? How things should be. And they'll work themselves right back into it. And looking at the families as systems, I can tell you it's not just you that wants things to be the same. Everybody else in your family, in your family system, which means the family of origin and the family of creation, everybody wants things to be exactly the same. And they're going to work very hard to make sure that they are exactly the same. And it's like I used to say, and in fact I was thinking of making this up as a poster, as a bumper sticker, maybe even as a tattoo, that I want to be the only element of chaos in my otherwise predictable and consistent world. And we all feel exactly the same. We want our world to be predictable, but we want to be the element of chaos in that world. So just imagine how this is for us. And we're going to take this out of the human element. We're going to place it for a moment in the animal kingdom. And this is something I used to teach about in psychology. I used to teach about this experiment many times and in many different ways because it's been repeated over and again. And it's about the little mice, the little mices, the little mouse that we train to be able to adjust certain elements of his environment. Now, a mouse's life is about adapting to his environment, not controlling his environment. But what we came to understand is that when you taught a mouse to control his environment, he became so absolutely obsessed with keeping his environment exactly as he wanted it, exactly as he engineered it, that he would give up everything in order to control his environment. For example, if we taught them how to adjust the lights in their environment. What does a rat know about light, right? I mean, one moment it's dark, the next moment it's bright. It doesn't matter to them. All they're interested in is eating and pooping and breeding and dying. That's it for a rat's life. Although I understand there's one rat that became a pretty good chef, and they made a movie about him, but we'll get back to that. Right now, the experiment was, we had this rat, and we taught this rat how to control the light in his room. And that, by the way, there was a number of experiments with a number of variables. We'll just talk about the light. When you have the rat, you starve the rat, and then you feed the rat. Well, the rat goes for the cheese. You know that's true. And if you adjusted the light while he was eating the cheese, after starving him, he would leave his cheese and go back and readjust the light back to the previous setting, and then come back and eat his cheese again. In other words, he would interrupt his own survival in order to ensure the consistency of his environment. The same thing with breeding. The same thing with even protection of their young. That a rat would abandon their young, even when their young were being threatened by another rat, they would abandon their young if there was a change in the lighting of their environment. They would go back and change that. Can you understand what that may mean for us? I mean, for those of us that are basically large rats, we have a greater desire for continuity than we even do for survival. Now, if keeping things the same is a matter of life and death survival for us, what are the odds that others are going to facilitate our change, or that we're going to be able to sustain change for any length of time? And let me tell you something, it is very, very poor if we do not have that series of reward and reinforcement of those behaviors, punishment of failures in this case, and a clarity of vision that drives us out of our comfort zone. And by the way, most of us are not that comfortable. So I like to change that and say this is a zone of familiarity, not a comfort zone. We're just simply not that comfortable. So if we can recognize that we're going to fail and that that's simply part of winning, right? Recognize that two steps up and one step back is still forward momentum. Yeah, even though at a snapshot glance we may see ourselves as regressing or as in a recidivistic motion, we have to remember that we're looking at things in the movie, not in the snapshot. It says that this is something I heard in a movie not too long ago. I saw it on an airplane, the only time I get to see movies anymore. The guy says, always believe that things are going to turn out well in the end. And if things aren't well, don't worry, it's not the end. If things aren't well, it's not the end. We want to see our lives as a movie, not as a snapshot. So if we look at the movie of our lives, we have to recognize that, frankly, we're going to fail from time to time, and that's okay. That is part of overall progress. Even relationships have to go through a time of crisis before they can lead to commitment. So in that sense, breaking up is part of staying together forever. And it's because we as individuals have to go through that crisis, which sometimes we're going to fail, we have to go through that crisis in order to meet the ultimate level of commitment that's going to ensure success. So we shouldn't take any snapshot out of our life and think that this is all we are, all that we can ever be. Recognize that recidivism, that failure is part of success, and we just simply reframe that as part of our journey. Now here we are. We've made a commitment. We've decided we're going to stop smoking or lose weight or exercise every day, climb Mount Everest, fly a jet plane or fly a kite, whatever it is that we decided we were going to do. P.S., I had once upon a time the dream that I was going to ride my bicycle from Seattle to San Diego. Now, I had that dream when I was 14 years old. And it took me until I was 44 years old to actually realize that dream. But that's okay. Everything I did up to that point was leading to that dream and the fulfillment of that activity. Every bicycle ride I took, every run that I took at night, every time I went camping, all of those things had an addition effect so that if you asked me when I was 15, and when was I going to take that ride, or 16, or 17, you can see it took a long time to get there, but that's all right. Now, that's the nature of progress. The key for us is never to abandon those dreams, those hopes, those goals. When we gain the clarity around what we want, it's because it's important. What's important about that? It's important what we want. So if we feel like abandoning that at any single moment, that would be the only true failure, is to completely abandon the dream. Failing is not a true failure. Failing is really just regrouping and recouping and trying again, because that's what humans do. I'm always impressed by the Latin word sin. Sin. Now, we think of sin as doing something morally wrong. But sin is not a moral term. It's an archery term. Sin means you are shooting at a target and you miss. So imagine you're an archer. You're out here shooting at a target. You have only really two outcomes, a hit or a sin. That is a miss. if you shot your arrow at the target and you missed, that is, you committed a sin, you missed the target, you missed the mark, what do? Give up? No, you restring that arrow and you let it fly again and again and again until you hit your target. Such is the nature of life. We are moving in the direction of hitting that target. And if we have to take 2, 3, 4, 5 arrow shots, we just keep right on going until we make it. And we recognize that the miss is actually a way of honing in our skill set in order to eventually hit the target. So we reframe any loss, any miss, any sin, we reframe that as an opportunity to adjust our aim and try again. And that's the nature of being human and the nature of moving forward. So for us, when we look at what it means to miss our mark, to miss our target, to not hit the things that we were actually looking at, that's just an opportunity to move forward. According to Prochaska, once again, in his book Changing for Good, he says, we go from pre-contemplation, that is, not aware that there is an issue, to contemplation, that is, awareness that there's something bigger out there, something we really respect and want. We go through that preparation phase where we're saying, we are going to get it now, we're going to reach for that brass ring. We take action, and then we work very hard to maintain that state. As that pop artist once said, musical artist once said, it wasn't about getting to the point of stardom, but staying there, right? I want so much to stay, he said. And that's what maintenance is about. Part of maintenance is self-sabotage and failure. In family systems, it's the sabotage of others trying to keep us in a place that keeps them comfortable. Because we really, really hate that level of uncertainty. So instead of allowing that, invite them on the journey with us. Or exclude them from a place of influence so that they can no longer reign on our parade. We're going to sabotage ourselves just fine. Thank you very much. We don't need any help from anybody else. But that's the key, is recognizing failure is part of success. Don't ever hate yourself for failing. Love yourself for trying. And if you miss the target, restring that arrow, fire it again, and if you miss the target, shoot another arrow. Don't worry. As long as you're still alive, there's still time to move forward and to make progress. Right? Everything's going to turn out well in the end. So if things aren't turning out well, don't worry. It's not the end. So that's the key for us as coaches. We're going to stop trying to fix things, and we're going to start trying to understand things. But we're only going to be able to understand others if we can learn to actively listen to them, ask the right questions, and stop trying to change them. And especially, stop trying to change them into little models of us, right? This is a journey of 1,000 miles. The journey of 1,000 miles begins directly under your feet, right? It begins by taking that first step. According to the stages of change, it begins by recognizing that a step can be taken, and then looking for what's important about taking that step. You haven't even taken action yet, and yet you've taken the biggest action of the entire journey, and that is recognizing it is within your power to take that next step. So take that first step, learn to move ahead, and remember you learn more from a person who's just one step ahead of you than you do from a person who's completed the journey. Conversely, you also learn more from somebody who's one step behind you. You learn from their failures, and more than you will from an individual who's on a completely different journey. So these are the stages of change. So speaking of stages, there are actually 3 stages in your coaching career. You've already taken the first step because you're here on your coaching call tonight. The next step that you'll want to look at is making yourself available for certification. There is a price tag that goes along with this. This call is free, and I'm very, very happy to be here to share this with you. There is a price tag that goes along with moving up a career path. To become a certified coach to the American Academy of Sports Medicine is about $2,500. That's cheap for a career change, don't you think? And then eventually you build a coaching career by following the pathway laid out by the International Coaching Federation. And that's going to cost a little bit more. But nevertheless, this is your career. You want to invest in yourself. You want to invest in your career. And as we said at the outset, you want to invest always in becoming a better listener and a better communicator. Last thing I'll say is when it's time for you to coach someone, don't think about having to know everything. Think about having to know only how to listen and how to ask questions. That's really all you need to understand. And then seek out those people that are most like you. A natural affinity between the coach and the client makes absolutely the very best magic possible. So that's it for our call this week. I hope to be back with you guys next week. I do have to say, there might be a chance that I'm going to be out of the country again. I've been invited to a clinic in India. Can you imagine that? A clinic in homeopathy that's just doing remarkable work. And so if I have the opportunity to take them up on that, why, off I'll go. And Dr. Ron Janer will be taking my place. You'll know that sometime in the future. You'll probably know that right after I do. So until then, everybody have just an absolutely outstanding week. Remember, change begins with that first step, and sometimes that first step is only recognizing that change is possible. Have a really good night, and I'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.